Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. 'Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Imagine a young person caught up in the legal system. What immediately springs to mind for you? Maybe a stern judge, a courtroom, perhaps even a jail cell. But what if that person is 13 or 15 or maybe 16 years old? The truth is, the juvenile justice system is profoundly different from the adult one. It operates under its own unique rules, its own definitions, and, well, a very specific philosophy. It's a system that's often, you know, deeply misunderstood. Yet it impacts thousands of young lives every single year in ways you might not expect. Today, we're embarking on a deep dive into the intricacies of juvenile procedures. Our mission is to cut through the complexities of this specialized area of law, extracting the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight, so that you can walk away truly well-informed about how the system handles minors. We'll be drawing directly from a comprehensive law enforcement training handout, giving you a real shortcut to understanding the nuances. We'll clarify exactly who the law considers a child, unpack the distinct terminology used in juvenile versus adult legal processes, explore when and how a child can be taken into custody, the very specific places they can be detained, and the remarkably strict rules governing their statements. We'll also touch on the critical roles of parents and schools, and even delve into the societal factors that contribute to youth gang involvement. This is going to be packed with insights and hopefully give you a much clearer picture of this vital aspect of public safety and child welfare. So, let's start at the very foundation, the philosophy behind juvenile justice. When most of us think about the justice system, punishment often comes to mind first. But the purpose of Title III, which is the Juvenile Justice Code, is much, much broader than just punishment. What's the overarching goal of this unique legal framework?
It's true. The design of the juvenile system is rooted in a fascinating dual mandate. It's not just about retribution for a wrong committed. The code fundamentally seeks to balance public protection and safety with the unique developmental needs of children. Its explicit purposes are quite remarkable. They include promoting the concept of accountability and consequences for criminal acts, which is vital for society, but also simultaneously aiming to remove what the law calls the taint of criminality from offending children whenever that's appropriate.
That dual mandate sounds like a tightrope walk, balancing holding a child accountable with essentially giving them a fresh start. How does the system strive to achieve both of those very different goals?
That tension is central to the entire framework. The code aims to provide treatment, training, and rehabilitation for these young individuals, all while emphasizing accountability and responsibility for both the parent and the child. It stresses the importance of fostering the child's care, protection, and their wholesome moral, mental, and physical development. The idea is to nurture growth, you know, not just penalize past actions.
So it's about acknowledging the act, but also focusing on who the child is and who they can become. And the family plays a crucial role.
Precisely. The system strives to achieve these goals within a family environment whenever possible. Separating children from their parents is supposed to happen only when it's absolutely necessary for their welfare or, you know, in the interest of public safety. And even when a child is removed, the code mandates that they receive the care that should ideally be provided by parents. It also dictates a simple judicial procedure that assures fair hearings and fully recognizes their constitutional and other legal rights. It's a comprehensive approach designed to prioritize the child's future.
That's a powerful statement about the system's intent. What this means for you, our listener, is that the juvenile system is, at its heart, designed with rehabilitation and the child's future in mind, not just retribution. It's trying to be a helping hand, not simply a punishing fist, aiming to guide young people back onto a positive path.
That's the ideal, yes. And a big part of understanding how it works and how it fundamentally differs from the adult system comes down to how it defines who is involved and what their actions are actually called.
Okay, let's delve into those definitions then. When we talk about this specific code, who exactly is considered a child? Is it simply anyone under 18? Because that would seem straightforward, but I suspect it's more nuanced.
You're right, it's where the nuances begin. The law defines a child as a person who is 10 years of age or older and under 17 years of age. However, there's a crucial extension. It also includes someone 17 years of age or older, but under 18, if they are alleged or found to have engaged in what we call delinquent conduct or conduct indicating a need for supervision, often shortened to CINS, as a result of acts committed before they turn 17.
Ah, so it's about their age at the time of the alleged offense, not necessarily their age when the case actually goes to court. Can you give us a quick example?
Exactly. So, for instance, if a young person commits an offense at 16, that case could still be handled under juvenile law, even if that individual turns 17 or almost 18 by the time the legal proceedings actually begin. The system essentially holds on to the juvenile status for acts committed during that specific age window. It ensures they get the protections and rehabilitative focus of the juvenile code.
That's a crucial distinction. Okay. What other key roles and definitions should we understand to truly grasp the specialized world?
Right. Beyond child, we encounter terms like parent. This refers to the mother or father, but notably not those whose parental rights have been legally terminated. Then there's custodian, defined as an adult with whom the child resides. And guardian, which is a court-ordered guardian, whether an individual or an agency. When we refer to a party in these proceedings, that encompasses the state, the child who is the subject of the case, or their parent, spouse, or guardian. The prosecuting attorney is the lawyer who regularly serves in a prosecutory capacity in juvenile court. A referral to juvenile court is simply when a child's case is directed to the designated official, like an intake or probation officer. And a valid court order is a judicial directive given to a child who has been found to need supervision, or CINS. Think of it as a formal instruction from the court for someone like a runaway, maybe, to ensure they comply with certain rules. Otherwise, there are consequences. Understanding these terms is foundational to seeing who holds responsibility and who the system is designed to serve.
Okay, this next area delves into something that sounds incredibly complex. When a child is navigating both the juvenile justice system and the child welfare system, how do these two often separate worlds intersect for a young person, and what does it mean to be a dual-status child?
It is incredibly complex, you're right, and it highlights the often intersecting vulnerabilities many children in the system face, which frequently stem from issues far beyond their alleged delinquent actions. A dual-status child is someone referred to the juvenile justice system who is also entangled with the Department of Family and Protective Services, or DFPS. This entanglement can manifest in several ways. For example, they could be in DFPS's temporary or permanent managing conservatorship, meaning DFPS has legal responsibility for their care. Or they might be the subject of a DFPS case where family-based safety...
Wow, that paints a picture of children who are not just alleged to have broken a law, but who might also be victims themselves or come from incredibly challenging home environments. What this means for you, our listener, is that a child's journey through the justice system isn't always about a single incident. It's often about a wider set of challenging circumstances that require a multi-agency response.
Exactly. And to further categorize children within the system, we also have the concept of a non-offender. This is a child who is subject to court jurisdiction under abuse, dependency, or neglect statutes for reasons other than illegal conduct. It also notably includes a child who is in custody solely for deportation out of the United States.
So this categorization reminds us that not every child interacting with the juvenile justice system is there because they broke a law. They might be there due to circumstances completely outside of their control, highlighting the system's broader role in child welfare.
Precisely. And then we have the critical distinctions between the types of offenses committed by a juvenile. These definitions fundamentally shape how the system responds.
This is critical for understanding the severity of a juvenile's actions and, crucially, the system's appropriate response. Let's break down these categories. Status offender versus delinquent conduct versus CINS or conduct.
Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Indicating a need for supervision.
Absolutely. Understanding these is fundamental. First, a status offender. This is a child accused or adjudicated for conduct that would not be a crime if committed by an adult. Think of it this way. If an adult did it, it wouldn't land them in legal trouble. Common examples include truancy, repeatedly skipping school, running away from home, violations of student codes of conduct, especially those leading to expulsion, violations of alcohol laws that apply only to minors, and minor municipal violations that apply only to minors, with a key exception that this excludes traffic offenses.
So essentially, these are behaviors that are only wrong because of the person's age. It really strikes me how something as seemingly minor as skipping school, if repeated, can actually pull a young person into a formal legal system. It makes you wonder how that initial contact shapes their perception of justice, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. That initial contact for a status offense can be a critical moment of intervention, or, if handled poorly, a gateway to further system involvement. Then we have delinquent conduct. This is distinctly different. It refers to conduct that would be a crime if committed by an adult. This generally includes most serious misdemeanors or felonies, typically Class B or above, excluding traffic offenses again. It also covers violations of court orders that constitute contempt in certain courts and serious intoxication offenses like driving while intoxicated, intoxication assault, or intoxication manslaughter. And notably, it includes third or subsequent offenses of driving under the influence of alcohol by a minor.
Okay, so that's where the actions start to mirror adult criminal behavior, carrying much more severe potential consequences. And what about CINS conduct indicating a need for supervision? How does that fit into the spectrum?
Conduct indicating a need for supervision, or CINS, covers a range of behaviors that, as the name suggests, indicate a child needs oversight and support. This category includes minor offenses like Class C misdemeanors, other than traffic offenses, if they're referred to juvenile court. It also covers voluntary absence from home, which is essentially running away, the use of inhalants, acts violating school district conduct standards that result in expulsion, and perhaps surprisingly to some, prostitution or its solicitation. Additionally, it includes the electronic transmission of certain visual material depicting a minor and making false reports to induce an emergency response, but only if the child has no prior adjudication for that specific type of false report.
So for you, our listener, the distinction between these offense types is absolutely critical. It dictates whether a child enters the formal, more criminal-like system or a more rehabilitative supervisory path. The legal system isn't just labeling an action, it's categorizing the appropriate response based on the nature of the act and the age of the offender, aiming for the least restrictive intervention possible.
And for the most serious patterns of behavior, there's also the definition of habitual felony conduct. This applies when a child engages in felony conduct, other than a state jail felony, and has at least two previous final adjudications for felony delinquent conduct. There are very strict requirements regarding the timing of these previous adjudications. Specifically, the second previous adjudication's conduct must have occurred after the first adjudication became final, and all appeals related to the previous adjudications must have been exhausted. This is a very particular legal status designed for repeat serious offenders.
So this is for the child who has a demonstrated pattern of severe felony offenses, and it can indeed lead to more severe consequences within the juvenile system. It's an indicator that the system has attempted intervention multiple times without success. So what does this all mean when we talk about the procedural divide between the adult and juvenile justice systems? It's not just a matter of age, it's a completely different legal language and approach.
Absolutely. The differences start right with how someone enters the system and the very language used to describe the process. In the juvenile system, you're taken into custody, not arrested.
Well,
the formal charge comes via a juvenile petition, which is quite different from an indictment or information in the adult world. Instead of being found guilty, a child is found delinquent.
And the nature of the proceedings themselves also changes, right? I've heard it described differently.
Indeed. The process is mainly civil in nature, even though, interestingly, the standard of proof for delinquent conduct is beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the same rigorous standard used in adult criminal cases. There's an adjudication instead of a conviction, and a disposition hearing replaces a sentencing hearing. When a plea is entered, it's a plea of true or not true instead of guilty or not guilty. This shift in terminology from criminal to civil sounding is a deliberate choice. It reflects the rehabilitative and non-punitive focus of the juvenile system.
What this means for you, our listener, is that understanding the specialized terminology is absolutely key to grasping the fundamental differences in intent and process between the two systems. It's not just a semantic exercise. It reflects the differing philosophies at play aimed at a different outcome for young people.
Building on that, the court structure and jurisdiction also reflect this unique approach. The law specifies that each county must have a juvenile board. And that board designates one or more existing courts, which could be a district, criminal district, domestic relations, or even a county court, to serve as the juvenile court. This means who handles juvenile cases can vary significantly by county, and that role can even change over time based on board designation. It's not a static setup.
So it's not like there's always a dedicated juvenile judge in every single county. The role can be quite fluid.
Precisely. The system allows for flexibility. Even if a designated juvenile court judge isn't available, any magistrate can make detention release determinations or conduct certain hearings. What's more, licensed attorneys can serve as referees for these hearings, further extending the system's reach and ensuring that cases can still proceed even in areas without dedicated juvenile judges. This flexibility ensures cases can move forward, but it also implies that procedures might vary slightly depending on who is presiding over the case. Adds another layer of practical difference.
And once a child is in the system, there's also a very clear distinction in terminology and, more importantly, in purpose between custody and detention facilities.
Absolutely. The law makes a strong distinction between a secure correctional facility and a secure detention facility. A secure correctional facility is a public or private residential facility, which can even include drug treatment facilities, used for the placement of juveniles who have been adjudicated as having committed an offense, or for non-offenders or others who have been convicted of a criminal offense. These facilities are specifically designed with physical restrictions for long-term placements after a finding of responsibility.
So that sounds like a more long-term post-adjudication placement, almost like a juvenile prison. What about a secure detention facility?
A secure detention facility, on the other hand, is for the temporary placement of juveniles who are accused of an offense, or for non-offenders or others who are accused of a criminal offense. Like correctional facilities, they also include physical restrictions designed to limit movement, but their purpose is strictly short-term pre-adjudication holding.
For you, our listener, this differentiates where children are held based on their status in the legal process, whether they are awaiting trial or have already been found responsible. It's not just jail. There are distinct layers of confinement based on the stage of their case, with a strong emphasis on temporary holding before any formal finding.
Understanding those distinctions sets the stage for how law enforcement engages with children in the first place.
So let's talk about that initial engagement. When can a law enforcement officer actually take a child into custody? What are the legal grounds for that? Because it's clearly not as simple as arresting an adult.
You're right. The legal requirements are quite specific. A child can be taken into custody in several ways. Firstly, it can be done pursuant to a direct order from the juvenile court. Secondly, it can happen under the general laws of arrest, which apply to all individuals, for instance, if an officer witnesses a crime. Thirdly, a law enforcement officer can take a child into custody if they have probable cause to believe the child has engaged in conduct violating a state penal law or a penal ordinance, or if they've engaged in delinquent conduct or conduct indicating a need for supervision.
Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. 'Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
The INS, or if they've violated a condition of probation imposed by the juvenile court.
So probable cause is key, similar to an adult, but the categories of offense are tailored to the juvenile system. Are there other specific roles or orders that allow for custody?
Yes, there are. A probation officer can also take a child into custody if there's probable cause to believe they violated a juvenile court probation order or a violation of release conditions set by the court or a referee. Additionally, a child can be taken into custody pursuant to a directive to apprehend, which is a specific juvenile court order. And finally, in a very specific scenario, a law enforcement officer can take a child into custody for violating compulsory school attendance laws, but only for the purpose of immediately returning them to their school campus to ensure compliance.
That last one really underscores the system's focus on education and keeping children in school. Now, you mentioned taken into custody versus arrest. Is taking into custody ever legally considered an arrest?
That's a critical legal distinction. Mm-hmm. The act of taking a child into custody is not considered an arrest, except for the very specific purpose of determining the validity of that custody or the validity of any search conducted. This distinction emphasizes the different underlying philosophy of the juvenile system. It's not about criminalizing the child, but intervening in their behavior.
That's important for procedural integrity. What about situations where custody might not be necessary and a warning is sufficient?
Right. Rather than taking a child into custody, a law enforcement officer may issue a warning notice. This is permissible if their agency has established guidelines for warning dispositions. Those guidelines have been approved by the county juvenile board, and the specific disposition is authorized by those guidelines. The warning notice must clearly identify the child and describe the alleged conduct. A copy must then be sent to the child's parent, guardian, or custodian as soon as practicable, and another copy must be filed with both the law enforcement agency and the office or official designated by the juvenile board. This notice can later be used as a basis for further action if necessary. It provides a less formal but still documented intervention designed to offer chance for correction without Dieter system involvement.
And you mentioned a directive to apprehend. Can you elaborate on that? It sounds like a very direct order.
It is indeed a very direct order, often referred to as an order of immediate custody. A juvenile court can issue this order at the request of a law enforcement or probation officer if the court finds there's probable cause to take the child into custody. Once issued, any law enforcement or probation officer is legally mandated to take the child into custody. And what's crucial here is that the order itself is not subject to appeal. It's a powerful, non-negotiable directive to ensure a child is brought into the system when needed, particularly in cases where they might be evading authorities.
So a very powerful tool. Are there any special notification duties if a child is already under guardianship, perhaps as a ward of the court?
Yes, absolutely. If a law enforcement officer takes a child who is a ward, meaning they are under legal guardianship, into custody, the officer or other person with custody must notify the court with jurisdiction over the child's guardianship. This notification must occur as soon as practicable, but no later than the first working day after the child is taken into custody. This ensures that the court responsible for the child's overall well-being is immediately aware of their involvement with the justice system, allowing for proper oversight and support for a child who is already in a vulnerable position. Now that we've covered how a child can be taken into custody, the next logical step is to understand where they can be held and under what conditions. The rules governing places of detention are very strict, designed to separate children from the adult system as much as possible, reflecting that rehabilitative philosophy.
So when a child is taken into custody, where exactly can they be detained? Are there specific designated places for them, or can they end up in a regular jail alongside adults?
That's a critical question, and the law is very clear. A child can be detained only in specific designated places: a juvenile processing office, a place of non-secure custody, a certified juvenile detention facility, a secure detention facility, a county jail, but only under very strict and limited conditions we'll discuss, or a non-secure correctional facility. It's not a free-for-all. Specific types of facilities serve specific, carefully regulated purposes.
What exactly is a juvenile processing office then, and how is it used differently from, say, a traditional jail cell?
A juvenile processing office is a specific designation. It's typically an office or a room, which might even be located within a police or sheriff's office, but it's specifically designated by the juvenile board for temporary detention. Crucially, it cannot be a cell or a holding facility that is used for other general detentions. The juvenile board can also prescribe conditions and limit the activities that may occur within it during this temporary detention. A child can only be detained here for up to 6 hours, and they cannot be left unattended. They're also explicitly entitled to be accompanied by a parent, guardian, custodian, or their attorney.
So it's really meant for very brief initial processing, not for extended holding. What are some of the permitted activities that can happen there during that short window?
Exactly. It's a quick stop point, designed to minimize the child's exposure to a more punitive environment. Permitted activities include returning the child to the custody of a responsible person, completing essential forms and records required by the juvenile court, photographing and fingerprinting, but only if that's otherwise authorized at the time issuing warnings or receiving a child statement under the very specific conditions we'll discuss later.
What this means for you, our listener, is that this highlights the system's attempt to keep juveniles separate from adult offenders even during that initial critical processing phase. It's about minimizing their exposure to the adult justice environment right from the start.
Building on that, another temporary holding option is non-secure custody. This is defined as an unlocked, multi-purpose area, like a lobby, an office, or an interrogation room. The key is that it's not designated or used as a secure detention area, and it's not part of one. In non-secure custody, a child cannot be physically secured, for example, to a cuffing rail. They can be held only long enough for identification, investigation processing, release to parents, or arranging transportation to the appropriate juvenile court, detention facility, or other authorized location. Residential use of this area is strictly prohibited, and continuous visual supervision is required. Similar to juvenile processing offices, detention here cannot exceed 6 hours, and the clock starts when they arrive, not when they are encountered in the field.
That's a lot of detail about temporary holding, but what about the absolute requirement for separation from adults, especially in facilities that might house both adults and juveniles? This sounds like a critical protection.
This is perhaps one of the most non-negotiable requirements, sight and sound separation. If a child is detained in a building that contains a jail, a lockup, or any other secure confinement area for adults, including alcohol or drug treatment facilities, they must be separated by sight and sound from those adults. This means they cannot see each other, and conversation between them must not be possible. This separation applies to all areas of the facility, including sally ports, passageways, admission areas, counseling rooms, sleeping quarters, dining areas, recreational spaces, and healthcare areas. This can be achieved through architectural design, typically. This protection even extends to 17-year-olds who have been transferred to criminal court for prosecution, reinforcing the system's commitment to shielding them from the adult criminal environment.
What this means for you, our listener, is that this is a fundamental protection designed to shield juveniles from the potentially harmful influences and environment of adult incarceration. It's a very deliberate effort to keep their path distinct.
And to ensure these standards are met, there's rigorous facility certification and oversight. Counties are mandated to provide suitable detention places, and the juvenile board in each county controls the conditions, terms, and supervision within these facilities, ensuring reasonable visitation times with the child. Pre-adjudication secure detention facilities can only be operated by a governmental unit or a private entity under contract with one, meaning accountability is tied to public oversight.
So there's a clear chain of responsibility and control. How is that suitability determined, and what happens if a facility isn't up to par?
This is where the oversight becomes very robust. Judges of the juvenile court and a majority of juvenile board members must personally inspect all public or private juvenile pre-adjudication secure detention facilities annually. They have to certify their suitability or unsuitability in writing to the operating and financial authorities and to the Texas Juvenile Justice Department, or TJJD. In making these determinations, they consider current monitoring and inspection reports from TJJD, compliance with local fire and building codes, the number of abuse, neglect, or exploitation allegations reported by the facility, and investigative summaries. They also assess the availability of health and mental health services, educational services, and the facility's overall appearance, security, maintenance, cleanliness, and environment. The TJJD also inspects these facilities and provides its own suitability reports. If a facility isn't certified as suitable or registered, a child detained there is entitled to immediate release. This rigorous oversight mechanism is designed to ensure proper standards of care and conditions for detained youth, reflecting the system's emphasis on their welfare. The ability of TJJD to deny, suspend, or revoke a facility's registration underscores the seriousness of compliance. It's a serious level of accountability, preventing children from being held in substandard conditions.
That's a powerful incentive for compliance. But are there ever exceptions to using a certified facility, perhaps in very rural areas or emergencies?
There are specific, limited circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, a child might be detained in a secure detention facility, even if it's not certified. But only if a certified one isn't available in the county, and the uncertified facility still meets TJJD short-term detention standards, maintains strict sight and sound separation, and has been designated by the local county juvenile board. Similarly, in non-metropolitan counties, a child can be detained in a county jail if other certified facilities aren't available. But again, this comes with strict sight and sound separation rules and requires annual certification by the juvenile court judges and board members. However, and this is crucial, after the initial detention hearing, continued detention must be in a certified facility.
So while there's a little flexibility in emergencies or rural areas, the underlying principle is still to move them to a proper juvenile facility as quickly as possible. What this means for you, our listener, is that these detailed regulations really show the extensive efforts to maintain a distinct and protective environment for juveniles, aiming to shield them from the adult system's harsher realities.
And finally, regarding physical movement, the law details the responsibility for transporting juvenile offenders. The law enforcement officer, who initially takes a child into custody, has the primary duty to transport them to the appropriate detention facility or school campus if the child isn't released to a parent or guardian. If the designated juvenile detention facility is located outside the county where the child was taken into custody, the transporting duty usually falls to that officer or the county sheriff, if authorized by the commissioner's court. For general court proceedings, the sheriff typically handles transportation if ordered by the juvenile board and commissioner's court, ensuring a clear chain of custody and accountability. With the child now in custody or being questioned, a paramount concern in the juvenile justice system is the admissibility of their statements and other evidence. This area has far more stringent rules than adult proceedings, reflecting the recognized vulnerability of minors and their developing understanding of legal processes.
This next point is truly crucial. How do the courts ensure a child's statement is truly voluntary and admissible, especially when they might not fully grasp the implications of what they're saying or their legal rights? This seems like a critical safeguard for young people.
It is indeed a critical safeguard, addressing the waiver of rights. Unlike adults, a child's rights, whether granted by state law, the Texas Constitution, or U.S. laws, can only be waived if very specific, heightened conditions are met. First, the waiver must be made by both the child and their attorney. Second, both the child and their attorney must be fully informed of and understand the specific right being waived and the possible consequences of waiving it. Third, the waiver must be completely voluntary. And fourth, it must be made either in writing or recorded as part of the court proceedings.
That's a significantly higher bar for waivers than for adults, where an adult can often waive rights without an attorney present in certain circumstances. What this means for you, our listener, is that this underscores the legal system's recognition of a child's unique vulnerability and their inherent need for greater protection during legal proceedings, acknowledging they might not be capable of fully understanding the weight of their decisions.
Moving to the admissibility of statements specifically, the rules are highly detailed and protective. It's important to note that these specific rules only apply to a child who is in custody or being subjected to a custodial interrogation.
So if a child is not in custody and is just being interviewed, the rules are different.
Precisely. If a child is not in custody and is not being interrogated, meaning it's a non-custodial interview, perhaps at their home with parents present, an officer can interview them and take statements without needing the formal magistrate Miranda warnings. The issue then becomes one of voluntariness, which is assessed by looking at the totality of the circumstances. This means courts will consider various factors like the child's age, their maturity, their life experience, their background, their intelligence, and their education to determine if the statement was truly freely given. Courts have consistently held that a child is not in custody if they are explicitly notified that they are not in custody, are told they are free to leave, and are in fact allowed to leave after the statement is taken. It's considered best practice to audio or video record these non-custodial interviews to create a clear record and demonstrate voluntariness.
That makes sense. It's about ensuring the child feels free to leave, not coerced. What about when a child is in custody and gives a written statement? That seems like it would require serious safeguards.
For custodial written statements to be admissible, the bar is incredibly high. The child must first receive magistrate warnings, and these warnings must be given by a judge, not an officer. The written statement must then be signed by the child in the physical presence of the magistrate, with no law enforcement officer present. The judge must be fully convinced that the child understands the nature and contents of the statement and is signing it voluntarily. And the judge must certify that they examined the child independently from law enforcement or the prosecutor. This ensures the judge acts as an impartial guardian of the child's rights.
Wow, that's an incredibly strict protocol designed to prevent any hint of coercion. What about audio or video recorded statements when a child is in custody?
The requirements are similar, but with a key difference. The same magistrate warnings are required, but they must be part of the recording itself. The child must then explicitly waive each right stated in the warning on that recording, and each voice must be clearly identified on the recording. The defense attorney is also entitled to a copy of this recording no later than 20 days before the proceeding begins. This ensures transparency and allows the defense to review the entire interaction, verifying that all safeguards were met.
And what about purely oral statements? Are those generally admissible, or are they viewed with more skepticism?
Generally, oral statements are far more restricted in their admissibility for juveniles. They are typically only admissible if they directly lead to the finding of secreted or stolen property or the instrument that was used in the offense, and these facts are corroborated as true and establish the child's guilt. They can also be admissible if they are res geste, meaning statements made spontaneously during or immediately after the event without time for reflection like an excited utterance. Lastly, oral statements made in open court at an adjudication hearing, before a grand jury considering a petition, or in a preliminary hearing are admissible because they are made in a formal, controlled setting.
What this means for you, our listener, is that this extensive process ensures an exceptionally high standard of legal protection for children, recognizing their potential susceptibility to coercion or misunderstanding. It's a far more protective framework than what applies to adults, reflecting the unique vulnerability of minors in the legal system.
Another important consideration for statements involves the age gray area. The Juvenile Justice Code.
Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Technically has jurisdiction until a person is 18 years of age, but in Texas, a person becomes an adult at 17. This creates a challenging overlap that officers and courts must navigate.
So if a crime occurs after someone turns 17, but they're still under 18, which rules apply? Are they treated as an adult immediately?
If the crime occurs after the person turns 17, adult rules apply for statements and procedures. However, if the crime occurred before they turned 17, but the person is now between 17 and under 18 when the proceedings begin, then juvenile rules apply. And even more complex, if the crime occurred before they turned 17, but the person is now over 18, adult rules for statements apply. Though the case would initially be handled by juvenile probation and prosecutors due to the nature of the original offense, it's generally safer for officers, if there's any doubt about a suspect's age, to follow juvenile procedures, because these procedures are more stringent and will satisfy adult rules if the suspect turns out to be an adult, but the reverse is not true. It's like having a universal wrench. It might be overkill for a small bolt, but it ensures you don't strip the threads, if you will.
That's a practical safeguard for law enforcement to avoid procedural errors. For comparison, in adult cases, when are statements required to be recorded? Because it's not always, is it?
For adult suspects, their statements must be electronically recorded in specific serious cases. These include murder, capital murder, kidnapping, sexual assault, continuous sexual assault of a child, sexual performance of a child, indecency with a child, and improper educator-student relationships. This isn't a discretionary choice. It's a mandatory requirement for these types of serious offenses, indicating the high stakes involved. Beyond statements, there are also strict regulations regarding fingerprinting and photographing children. This is another area where the protective philosophy of the juvenile system really shines through.
So when can you actually fingerprint or photograph a child It seems like that would be highly restricted given the system's protective philosophy to avoid creating records that follow them.
You're absolutely right. It is highly restricted. Generally, a child cannot be photographed or fingerprinted without the specific consent of the juvenile court, unless they are taken into custody or are referred to the juvenile court for felony conduct or a misdemeanor punishable by confinement, regardless of whether they are in custody at that moment. The default is judicial oversight.
Are there exceptions, perhaps, for investigative purposes, like comparing prints found at a crime scene?
Yes, there are very specific exceptions for comparison purposes. A law enforcement officer can take temporary custody of a child to take their fingerprints. If they have probable cause to believe the child engaged in delinquent conduct, they've found other fingerprints during the investigation, and they have probable cause to believe the child's fingerprints will match those other fingerprints. Similarly, for photographs, temporary custody can be taken if there's probable cause of delinquent conduct and probable cause that the child's photo will be of material assistance in the investigation. Importantly, this type of temporary custody is not considered a formal taking into custody, and it cannot be reported to the juvenile justice information system.
That's a very fine line to walk, balancing investigative needs with protecting the child's record. What happens to these temporary fingerprints or photos if they don't lead to a positive identification?
They must be immediately destroyed if they do not lead to a positive comparison or identification. Additionally, the officer must make a reasonable effort to notify the child's parent, guardian, or custodian of the action taken. These fingerprints or photographs can be obtained at a juvenile processing office or any private location that affords reasonable privacy to the child.
And what if a child is taken into custody because they're a runaway and their identity can't be determined? Can they be fingerprinted then?
For identifying runaways, the law allows for fingerprinting or photographing under specific conditions. If an officer takes a child into custody for running away, which is a CINS offense, and cannot determine their identity after making a reasonable effort, they may fingerprint or photograph the child solely to establish identity. Once the child's identity is determined, or if it's determined that they cannot be identified by the prints or photos, all copies must be immediately destroyed.
That's a strong emphasis on destruction, which shows the intent to protect a child's privacy and avoid unnecessary records. Is there oversight on this destruction to ensure compliance?
Absolutely. To ensure compliance, the head of each municipal or county law enforcement agency must annually certify to the juvenile board that all photographs and fingerprints required to be destroyed have, in fact, been destroyed. Providing a false certification is a serious matter and is subject to prosecution for perjury. What this means for you, our listener, is that these strict rules demonstrate a clear intent to protect children's privacy and avoid unnecessary records that could follow them into adulthood, clearly differentiating their experience from adult criminal records.
Finally, what about polygraph examinations for children? We know they're controversial even for adults.
The law is quite clear. If a child is taken into custody, a polygraph examination cannot be administered without the explicit consent of the child's attorney or the juvenile court, unless the child has been formally transferred to criminal court for prosecution as an adult. This further layer of protection acknowledges the potential for undue influence or misunderstanding on a minor during such a procedure and, well, the general unreliability of polygraphs. Once a child is taken into custody, the procedural clock starts ticking rapidly, and the system prioritizes release unless specific compelling conditions for detention are met. This reflects the system's foundational philosophy of keeping children out of confinement as much as possible.
So after a child is taken into custody, what's the immediate next step? Are they automatically detained, or is there a strong push towards release and diversion?
There's a very strong push towards immediate release. The person taking a child into custody must, without unnecessary delay and without first taking the child anywhere other than a juvenile processing office, do one of several things. They can release the child to a parent, guardian, custodian, or another responsible adult who promises to bring the child to court as requested. Alternatively, they can take the child to the juvenile board's designated office or official if there's probable cause of delinquent conduct, CINS, or a probation violation. They can also bring the child to a designated detention facility or a secure detention facility. If the child appears to suffer from a serious physical condition or illness, they can be taken directly to a medical facility for prompt treatment. The officer might also dispose of the case without a formal court referral. Or, if school is in session, the child could be taken directly to their school campus if the principal or a peace officer there agrees to take responsibility for the remainder of the school day. In all cases, the person taking custody must promptly notify the child's parent, guardian, or custodian, and the juvenile board's designated office or official about the custody and the reason for it.
That's a lot of options, indicating a clear preference for avoiding formal detention where possible. What about intoxication offenses for juveniles? Are there special rules for breath or blood specimens, given their age?
Yes, there are. For juveniles involved in intoxication offenses, the law specifies that they can be asked for a breath specimen without an attorney present. But the request and the child's response must be videotaped and maintained as evidence. This is a critical safeguard for transparency. However, requests for blood specimens require the consent of an attorney or the court, making them much rarer to obtain from juveniles. It's also crucial to remember the difference between DUI minor, which means any detectable amount of alcohol in a minor system, and DWI, which is driving with impaired mental and physical faculties. Juveniles can indeed be charged with DWI like adults if their faculties are impaired, not just if they have a detectable amount of alcohol. This means the consequences can be much more severe.
So there's a distinction in how the alcohol offenses are handled, but also the possibility of a more serious DWI charge. Once a child is referred, what happens during the preliminary investigation, and what are the specific reasons a child would not be released from detention?
Upon referral, an intake officer, a probation officer, or another person authorized by the juvenile board must conduct a preliminary investigation. Their immediate task is to determine if the person is truly a child within the meaning of the code, and if there's probable cause to believe the child has engaged in delinquent conduct, CINS, or if they are a non-offender being held solely for deportation. If either the person is not a child or there's no probable cause, the child must be immediately released. The system prioritizes freedom unless a clear justification for detention exists.
So release is the default unless there are specific, compelling reasons to detain. What are those reasons that override the preference for release?
Exactly. A child will only be detained if warranted, based on very specific considerations. These include if the child is likely to abscond or be removed from the court's jurisdiction, if there's no suitable supervision, care, or protection for the child in the real world, if there's no parent or other responsible person able to return the child to court when required, if the child is a danger to themselves or poses a clear threat to public safety if released, or if they were previously adjudicated for delinquent conduct that would be a jailable or prison offense for an adult and are likely to reoffend if released, and a particularly serious reason for detention is if the child is accused of delinquent conduct involving the use, possession, or exhibition of a firearm, in which case a judge must see the case for the detention determination.
What this means for you, our listener, is that unless one of these very specific and serious conditions is met, the juvenile will be released. It underscores the legal preference for keeping children out of confinement while their case progresses through the system. The bar for detention is deliberately high.
If a child is detained based on those criteria, the system then mandates incredibly swift and structured detention hearings. These are a cornerstone of protecting juvenile rights.
So if a child is detained based on those criteria, what's the very next step? There are strict timelines, right? It's not like they can just be held indefinitely.
Absolutely. The timelines are incredibly strict. If a child is detained, a detention hearing without a jury must be held no later than the second working day after the child is taken into custody. If they were taken into custody on a Friday or Saturday, that timeline is even tighter. The hearing must be held by the first working day. Parents must be promptly notified of this hearing, and an attorney will be appointed for the child if one isn't already retained. During the hearing, the court will consider written reports from probation officers and other professionals. Unless the judge can justify continued detention based on those specific criteria we just discussed, the child will be ordered released. If the child is ordered detained, another detention hearing will be held within 10 working days and then periodically thereafter for as long as the child remains in detention. It's a system of continuous judicial review of their confinement.
Are the rules different for status offenders or non-offenders, since their alleged conduct is less severe and sometimes not even criminal?
Yes, very much so. For status offenders and non-offenders, the detention hearing must be held even faster, before the 24th hour after their arrival at the facility, excluding weekends and holidays. Generally, these children must be released from secure detention. An exception exists for children who violated a valid court order. They can be detained for up to 72 hours if there's probable cause for the violation and specific justification for detention based on absconding risk, lack of supervision, or danger to public safety. This 72-hour period can be extended for another 72 hours for good cause, or even up to 10 working days at the defense attorney's request to prepare for an adjudication hearing. Crucially, non-offenders, including those held solely for deportation, cannot be detained in a secure facility for any period of time. Doing so entitles them to immediate release and allows for civil action against those responsible, and is even a criminal offense for the person who knowingly detains them.
What this means for you, our listener, is that these swift and structured hearings with extremely high thresholds for continued detention are a cornerstone of protecting juvenile rights and minimizing unnecessary confinement. It really underscores the system's commitment to keeping children out of lockup, if at all possible, especially when their behavior isn't inherently criminal.
Complementing that, the system also has robust provisions for disposition without referral to court.
Mm-hmm.
This highlights the strong preference for diverting cases away from formal judicial proceedings when appropriate.
So this is about diverting cases before they even get formally into the court system, perhaps like a pre-charge intervention.
Exactly. For Class C misdemeanors, other than traffic offenses, a case can be disposed of without formal referral to juvenile court or charging the child. This happens if the law enforcement agency has guidelines for such dispositions. Those guidelines are approved by the county juvenile board, and the specific disposition is authorized. The officer makes a written report of this disposition to their agency. It's important that such dispositions cannot keep the child in law enforcement custody or require periodic reporting, ensuring a light touch. Instead, they might involve referring the child to an agency other than the juvenile court, a brief conference with the child and their parent to address the behavior, or a referral for services for both the child and the parent.
That sounds like an excellent way to handle minor infractions without stigmatizing the child. Are there specific programs for first-time offenders who might benefit from this approach?
Yes. The Juvenile Board can establish first offender programs. These are designed for CINS offenses, Class C misdemeanors that aren't traffic-related, or less serious delinquent conduct. However, these programs are not for the most serious offenses. Things like first, second, or third-degree felonies, capital felonies, aggravated controlled substance felonies, or violent state jail or misdemeanor crimes involving violence or weapons. Both the child and their parent must consent to participate in these programs, and if successfully completed, the case is closed without formal referral to the court system.
That's a huge opportunity for a young person to correct their path without a formal record. Are these informal guidelines mandatory for law enforcement to use?
The law specifies that these informal disposition guidelines are not mandatory. And importantly, they cannot be used if there's probable cause to believe that the child may be a victim of human trafficking, because in such cases, deeper intervention and protection are immediately necessary. What this means for you, our listener, is that these diversion programs are a significant aspect of the juvenile system's rehabilitative focus, aiming to address root causes and prevent deeper involvement in the justice system. It's about early intervention and support, trying to catch problems before they escalate.
Given the range of offenses we've discussed, how does the system handle the most serious cases, those that might typically lead to adult prison time? Does a grand jury get involved with juveniles, which is a process we usually associate with adult felony cases?
That's where determinate sentencing and grand jury involvement come into play for the most severe offenses. For these cases, a prosecuting attorney may refer the juvenile petition to a grand jury. This applies to habitual felony conduct, or offenses like murder, capital murder, aggravated kidnapping, sexual assault, aggravated robbery, serious injury to a child, felony level, felony deadly conduct with a firearm, certain serious drug felonies, criminal solicitation, indecency with a child, criminal solicitation of a minor, criminal attempt of serious felonies, arson resulting in injury or death, intoxication manslaughter, or conspiracy to commit these serious offenses.
So it's a very specific and limited list of the gravest offenses that opens the door to grand jury involvement. How does that grand jury process work for juveniles since they can't issue a traditional indictment?
The process is similar to an adult indictment in terms of grand jury review. The grand jury approves the petition by a vote of 9 members. While they have all the powers to investigate the facts and circumstances relating to the petition, they cannot issue a formal indictment unless the child is later transferred to criminal court. If the grand jury approves the petition, that certification is entered into the juvenile court record and can, in certain circumstances, serve as a regular indictment for transferring the child to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. This process can lead to a determinate sentence, which means a sentence that extends past the juvenile's 19th birthday, contrasting with an indeterminate sentence that terminates before their 19th birthday. This is the closest the juvenile system comes to adult-like sentencing.
What this means for you, our listener, is that this is the path for the most severe juvenile cases, where the potential consequences can more closely resemble the adult system, allowing for longer periods of supervision or confinement when the nature of the crime and the child's history warrant it.
And this leads us directly to the concept of waiver of jurisdiction and discretionary transfer to criminal court. This is how, in certain extreme circumstances, a juvenile can sometimes end up being prosecuted as an adult in the criminal justice system.
This is a pivotal distinction. So a juvenile court has the discretion to waive its exclusive original jurisdiction and actually transfer a person to an adult criminal court. When is that even possible? It seems like it would be a very last resort against the rehabilitative philosophy.
It is indeed a rare and highly scrutinized last resort, governed by very specific criteria. This transfer is possible if the person is 18 years of age or older, and they were between 10 and under 17 when they allegedly committed a capital felony or murder, or if they were between 14 and under 17 for an aggravated controlled substance felony or a first-degree felony, excluding murder, or if they were between 15 and under 17 for any other felony. But there's a crucial additional condition. This can only happen if no adjudication has been made concerning the alleged offense, and the juvenile court finds by a preponderance of the evidence that it was not practical to proceed in juvenile court before the person's 18th birthday.
Not practicable. That's an interesting legal phrase. What would make it not practicable to proceed in the juvenile court system before their 18th birthday?
It means that for reasons beyond the state's control, or despite diligent efforts by the state, it simply wasn't feasible to complete the juvenile proceedings before the individual turned 18. This could be due to factors like new evidence suddenly being discovered years after the crime, the suspect not being found despite diligent efforts and only apprehended later. Or even if a previous transfer order was reversed or set aside on appeal, requiring the case to restart, it acknowledges that justice doesn't always unfold neatly or immediately.
Can you give us a concrete example of how this might play out in the real world?
Certainly. Imagine a situation where a sexual assault is committed by a 15-year-old on an 11-year-old victim. However, the victim doesn't report it for 3 years due to trauma or fear. By the time the report is made and the suspect is identified, the suspect is now 17 years old, almost 18. This statute then allows for the case to be transferred to the adult system because it was not practicable for the state to proceed in juvenile court before the suspect's 18th birthday. Due to circumstances like the delayed report, provided, of course, that due diligence was exercised by the authorities in investigating once the report was made.
What this means for you, our listener, is that this explains how some individuals who committed offenses as juveniles can legally be prosecuted in the adult system, especially for serious crimes with delayed discovery or other factors that genuinely prevented timely juvenile proceedings.
And finally, and this is a key component of the rehabilitative philosophy, is the effect of adjudication or disposition. An order of adjudication or disposition in the juvenile system is not considered a criminal conviction.
So it's not a conviction, and it doesn't carry the same lifetime weight that an adult criminal record might. That's a significant difference.
Exactly. It does not result in any civil disability or disqualification for civil service applications or appointments. Its use is extremely limited. It can only be used in situations where the individual is still a juvenile and is a party to new offenses, or for civil commitment under health and safety codes, such as for mental health or substance abuse treatment. It's designed to allow a young person to move past their mistakes.
What this means for you, our listener, is that this provision is absolutely key to the rehabilitative philosophy of the juvenile system, aiming to prevent a single mistake in youth from permanently hindering a young person's future opportunities for employment, education, and civic life. It's designed to provide a real chance at a clean slate, to support their future rather than define it by their past.
Beyond the strict legal procedures, the juvenile justice system deeply intersects with other critical components of a child's life, their family, their school, and unfortunately sometimes negative peer influences like gangs.
Parental involvement is explicitly a cornerstone of the juvenile justice system, unlike the adult system where parents are not legally central. What are the key rights and duties that the law lays out for parents, especially when their child is involved with the justice system?
Parental rights and duties are indeed foundational and quite comprehensive. Parents have fundamental rights, including physical possession of the child, directing their moral and religious training, and designating their residence. They also have the duty of care, control, protection, and reasonable discipline of the child, along with the duty to support the child by providing clothing, food, shelter, medical and dental care, and education. This duty to support continues as long as a child is an unemancipated minor and fully enrolled in high school. Parents also have the right to manage the child's estate, consent to marriage, military enlistment, and medical care, represent the child in legal action, and make education decisions. Importantly, only parents, grandparents, step-parents with a duty of control, or guardians with a duty of control, may use corporal punishment for reasonable discipline.
That's a comprehensive list, clearly affirming the parent's primary foundational role. Is there anything that state agencies cannot do regarding parental rights, even when the system is involved?
Yes, very specifically, state agencies cannot adopt rules or policies or take any other action that violates a parent's fundamental right to direct their child's upbringing. This is a crucial limitation on state intervention, reinforcing the sanctity of the family unit. Even if a parent is a conservator with limited possession of the child during their period of possession, they still retain duties of care, control, protection, reasonable discipline. Support for non-invasive medical, dental care, and directing moral and religious training. What this means for you, our listener, is that this reinforces the legal recognition of the family unit's importance and the parent's primary, often protected, role in a child's life, even when the justice system becomes involved, emphasizing a collaborative approach. This also leads to important distinctions between civil and criminal incidents regarding child custody. It's crucial for officers to understand that many child custody disputes are purely civil matters, and law enforcement's role is limited. Officers can only intervene if a crime is about to occur or is taking place, or if the child is in apparent immediate danger. They don't just enforce civil court orders.
So they can't just enforce a civil custody order unless there's an actual crime happening or an immediate threat. What kind of crimes related to child custody might specifically warrant law enforcement intervention?
Exactly. Officers should consider if specific crimes related to child custody have been committed, such as interference with child custody, agreeing to abduct a child, enticing a child, harboring a runaway child, or interference with the rights of a guardian. Beyond these specific crimes, officers also have a crucial role in reporting to Child Protective Services, or CPS. Officers must report to CPS and document the report number whenever there's cause for concern for a child's health or safety involving a caretaker. Even if clear criminal offense elements aren't met or it doesn't justify taking emergency possession of the child.
That's a good distinction. A welfare concern is different from a criminal act, but both require a response. But does CPS have special authority to enter a home without a warrant, or do officers still need to adhere to normal legal entry rules?
It's a common misconception, but CPS does not have greater authority to enter premises without a warrant than law enforcement. Officers must remember their training on legal entry, meaning they still require consent, a warrant, or exigent circumstances to enter a private residence. What this means for you, our listener, is that this clarifies the boundaries of law enforcement intervention in family matters, distinguishing criminal offenses from civil disputes or welfare concerns, and ensuring proper legal procedure is followed, upholding constitutional rights even in sensitive situations.
How does the school system fit into all of this? Are schools notified when a student is involved with law enforcement? And if so, what kind of information is shared? Because that seems like a vital connection for student safety and support.
Yes, there are very strict notification requirements. A law enforcement agency must orally notify the school superintendent or their designee within 24 hours of an arrest or referral. Or before the next school day, whichever is earlier, if a public primary or secondary student is arrested or referred for any felony or specific serious misdemeanors. These misdemeanors include unlawful restraint, assault, deadly conduct, terroristic threat, drug offenses, or weapon offenses. Written notification must follow within 7 days. Similar rules apply for private school students with notifications going to the principal or their designee.
That's a lot of information being shared. Is it confidential, and what specific details are included in these notifications?
These notices are strictly confidential, and unauthorized disclosure is classified as a Class C misdemeanor, a clear sign of their sensitive nature. Both the oral and written notices must include pertinent details about the offense or conduct, including any assaultive behavior or other violence, specific weapons used, or weapons possessed during the offense. If requested by the superintendent or designee, any suspect information needed for a threat assessment or the preparation of a safety plan related to the student must also be provided. Prosecuting attorney offices also have notification duties regarding convictions, deferred prosecutions, deferred adjudications, or adjudications of delinquent conduct, especially if sex offender registration is required. Additionally, parole, probation, and community supervision offices notify schools about student transfers or re-enrollments. It's a very interconnected system designed to ensure student safety and appropriate support.
What happens if these notifications aren't made? Is there accountability for agencies that fail to report?
Absolutely. Failures to provide required notifications must be reported. School personnel failures are reported to the State Board for Educator Certification, which oversees teacher licensing. Law enforcement failures are reported to TCOL, the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement, which licenses police officers. And prosecution failures are reported to the elected district attorney responsible for the operation of their office. What this means for you, our listener, is that these provisions highlight the crucial interconnectedness of safety and justice. Ensuring schools are aware of potential risks or support needs for their students, and that accountability is maintained across all agencies involved in a young person's life. So far, we've dissected the legal framework of the juvenile system, but these procedures don't exist in a vacuum. A child's journey through the system is deeply influenced by their environment, their family, their school, and often the powerful draw of peer groups, including gangs. This brings us to a critical question. What draws young people into gang activity in the first place, and what are the underlying societal and individual factors at play?
This is such a critical societal issue, often tragically impacting young lives. What does the research tell us about those risk factors that make a young person vulnerable to gang involvement?
Research identifies five main domains of risk factors for youth gang involvement. First, individual factors. These include problem behaviors, acting out, experiencing negative life events, and sadly, often being a victim of crime or other harmful situations themselves. Second, family factors. This domain encompasses disrupted family structures, such as those resulting from death or divorce, poor supervision from parents, inconsistent discipline, and a general lack of parental interest or involvement in the child's life. Third, school factors. This includes poor academic performance, a low attachment to school, a poor school environment, and learning disabilities that can create feelings of alienation or failure, pushing youth away from traditional support structures. Fourth, peers. This is considered one of the strongest factors influencing gang involvement. Peer groups can normalize antisocial behavior and significantly contribute to a young person's alienation from mainstream society, offering an alternative sense of belonging. And fifth, community factors. Issues like widespread poverty, environmental instability, and neighborhood disorganization play a very significant role in predisposing youth to gang involvement, creating a fertile ground for recruitment.
Those factors paint a grim picture, suggesting a lot of fundamental needs might not be met elsewhere for these young people. What specific needs do gangs fulfill for young people that might draw them in, even if they aren't forced to join?
While the presence of multiple risk factors definitely increases the likelihood of involvement, it's important to remember that most youth are not forced to join gangs. Instead, gangs often fulfill a range of needs that are unmet in other areas of a young person's life. These include a desire for status, a sense of self-worth or esteem, acceptance and belonging, credibility or notoriety, and even the lure of fun, excitement, and risk-taking. For some, it's a substitution for boredom. They also offer a sense of bonding, opportunities to obtain wealth and materialism through illicit means, and crucially, a sense of survival or protection in dangerous environments.
It sounds like gangs provide a distorted sense of community and opportunity when legitimate paths feel blocked or unavailable. What are the broader societal strains that contribute to the rise of gangs, creating this environment where they can flourish?
On a deeper societal level, the underlying strains that give rise to gangs include high unemployment, a lack of primary groups for bonding like strong family or community ties, an atmosphere of discrimination, abuse, or criticism, and a community that is perceived as uncaring. Other factors are an environment that uses intimidation and aggression to solve problems, a youth's lack of self-control development and respect for self and others, and the plain profitability of illegal activity that draws in those seeking quick financial gains. All these factors combine to create fertile ground for gang recruitment.
And how does a young person's involvement typically progress once they're drawn into a gang? Is it an immediate dive into serious crime?
Gang involvement typically progresses through three phases. It often begins subtly, with minor mischief, perhaps just tagging or low-level vandalism. This then progresses to a phase of seeking identity, which is manifested through visible signs like specific colors, hand signals, clothing, tattoos, slogans, graffiti, bandanas, and jackets, outward displays of belonging. This visible identity then culminates in the third phase. More serious crime and criminal behavior, such as drive-by shootings, drug dealing, and even killings, as the individual becomes more deeply entrenched and commits to the gang's activities.
What this means for you, our listener, is that understanding these complex factors, from individual vulnerabilities to broad societal strains and the progression of involvement, is crucial for developing truly effective prevention and intervention strategies to steer youth away from gang involvement and towards healthier, more positive paths. It's a challenge that requires a holistic understanding, recognizing that legal procedures are just one piece of a much larger puzzle. Today, we've navigated the intricate world of juvenile justice, moving far beyond simple definitions to explore the nuanced procedures, distinct legal terminologies, and the deeply rooted philosophies that truly set it apart from the adult system. We've seen how the law attempts to balance public safety with a profound commitment to the care, protection, and rehabilitation of children. From the careful handling of custody and statements to the rigorous oversight of detention facilities and the vital efforts towards diversion and parental involvement, the system is designed to provide second chances and foster positive development for young people.
It's a system that fundamentally believes in the potential for young people to change, to learn from their mistakes, and to reintegrate positively into society. It's designed to provide a path forward, not just a dead end, constantly balancing accountability with the immense potential for growth in a young life.
Which brings us to a final provocative thought for you, our listener. Given the juvenile system's dual goals of public safety and rehabilitation, and the profound impact these procedures have on a young person's developing life, how can communities best support the success of juveniles both within and outside of this complex system? What role can you play in ensuring these young individuals receive the care and guidance they need to thrive and contribute positively to society rather than being trapped in a cycle of reoffending?
It's a question that challenges us all to consider our collective responsibility in nurturing the next generation and shaping a more just and supportive future.
We hope this deep dive has provided you with a clearer understanding and perhaps sparked further curiosity about this vital, often unseen aspect of our justice system. We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.